You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Today's guest on the podcast is my good friend, Dr. Jacob Stoyle. He is the Chair of Applied History with us, the Modern War Institute at West Point, an Associate Professor of Military History at the United States Army School of Advanced Military Studies, also known as SAMS. He's a senior fellow with our 40th Infantry Division Urban Warfare Center, assistant director of the Second World War Research Group, North America, trustee of the U.S. Commission on Military History, and a founding member of the International Working Group on Subterranean Warfare. Dr. Stoyle received his doctorate in history from the University of Oxford. And all of his comments today do not reflect that of the U.S. Army and only his and his research. Jacob, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, John. It's great to be back with you.
Now, I said welcome back because actually I was just looking back at our last episode, which was Israel, Gaza, and the Looming Challenges of Urban Warfare. We released on October 13th. So if listeners want to go back and listen to, you know, lots changed since then, but that episode, I definitely recommend that. But the reason I asked Jacob to come back on is we just finished our 40th Infantry Division Urban Operations Planners course that we held from 24th to the 31st of August. Jacob is not just a fellow, but he's also a key designer, and he's worked with me and General Woolridge designing the course using standard learning methodologies and course development and everything. So couldn't have done it without Jacob. But one of the classes that Jacob teaches in the course, which has a heavy history lens, of course, and there's only two historians that I actually like. One is Jacob, the other is Jason Giroux, as most listeners will know, but I try to learn from the past. But one of the classes that Jacob teaches in the course is divisional operational approaches, offense and defense. I really enjoy every year that he gives it, and each year it gets even better and better. But I asked Jacob to come on this show and give the listeners this amazing presentation on divisional operational approaches to offensive operations. So basically, how do you conduct operations offensively in large urban areas? As I've been to many of our combat training centers, and there is a kind of an issue with applying one style, which is a deliberate attack, but I know Jacob will cover it. Jacob, I really appreciate you coming on this show and really interested in hearing again, hopefully with a couple questions throughout, your presentation on divisional operational approaches to the offense.
Well, John, thank you. And thank you for the kind introduction. It's always great to work with you. And, you know, I've really valued our years working together on the Urban Operations Planners course together with General Woolridge and the entire team out in 40th ID. So what I'm going to talk to a bit today is exactly what you said, but I want to caveat it a little bit that it's not just for divisions. This talk is really designed for echelons above brigade, but as I've now been informed by some of our awesome doctor and writers, some of these approaches are also reflected in the new ATP 3, I want to say TAC 06, 11, which deals with brigade attacks in urban operations. So these are a spectrum of approaches. They're really designed for division and above, but perhaps brigade planners and others might find some value in them. And the way I kind of propose to do this is to go through, to start with some general considerations of planning the offensive into an urban area, and then go into some of the specific approaches. And what I'm not going to do is recommend any approach. There are some approaches that I might counsel probably against, but there are none that I'm going to recommend, because one of the key concepts behind an operational approach is that it's situation dependent. So what I'm going to do really is lay out some operational approaches and some of the key variables that can help you as a planner, if you're a planner who's listening or a commander who's listening, determine which approach is right for you given your situation. But before we even get to that, we should start with some general considerations. The first kind of consideration to think about is on the nature of urban terrain. What are we really talking about here? And one of the big challenges is there really are a lot of competing definitions of urban and rural. By the way, for those who listen who've ever touched rural studies, gets even more complicated as to what is not urban. Suffice it to say, you'll know whether these approaches are right for you when at Echelon, the terrain you're facing, the man-made built-up terrain, has enough of a challenge that it cannot be overcome in a normal maneuver-based approach as you would in rural terrain. So once the terrain is of sufficient man-made density, once it has those urban characteristics that I know John's talked about on a number of other podcasts, right, that's when you should start kind of looking into these kit bag of approaches. The second issue that's a general consideration to think about is force density. Urban operations at scale are tremendously, tremendously force intensive. And Anthony King, in his work, Dr. Anthony King from the UK, has pointed out a lot of the issues this causes and has actually taken a stab at some of these force density concepts, especially when you look at issues like Stalingrad, etc., of how many forces it takes. Another key consideration, and I know there's some disagreement on this, especially from my colleagues Stuart Lyle and Jason Giroux, is that in my opinion, the urban terrain does favor the defense and that has to be handled. Now, you can turn it into something that favors the offense, but that depends on your approach and getting the approach right. And part of the way to conceive of urban terrain, in to some extent, is thinking about fortified or defensive lines that exist in significant depth. So if you're picturing a World War I battlefield where the complex defensive lines, the complex terrain extends 3-5 miles into depth, it's not a bad analogy for urban terrain. And of course, you have the issue of civilians in the battle space. You have issues with maintaining and sustainment and evacuation routes, casualty evacuation routes because of issues of route security and route security in the urban space. You have challenges with intelligence collection in urban terrain. You have challenges with what would be follow-on operations. And all of this comes to a challenge of maintaining combat power, maintaining tempo, and maintaining coherence to avoid culmination. These are really the critical issues for a planner when they start to look at urban terrain is how do you maintain combat power? How do you maintain tempo, control of tempo? And how do you maintain your force coherence? One of the challenges to this, of course, is the ability for hit and run attacks in the urban area, the ability for an enemy to leverage the subterranean environment. And all of this should lead to a very first planning question is, do you have, when you're looking at any of these operational approaches, do you have the force structure and the equipment necessary to carry them out? Some of these are going to be very engineering intensive. And if you don't have the engineer capabilities, then that operational approach is probably not for you. Similarly, some of these require a fairly extreme form of mission command. And if you don't have that kind of trust in subordinate operate units, these are probably not for you. Another set of considerations before we get into that are just planning factors to think about before you hit an urban operation is the issue of what used to be called phase four, this idea of stability or really dealing with the normal civilian population. And one of the ways I like to conceive of this is in an urban operation, phase four is continuous. There is no separate phasing. And at some point, you're going to have to be on the defense, and phase four is also the phase 0, 1, and 2 of the defense. And among the planning considerations you're going to need to bring into your kind of offensive mindset because of those civilian populations is the issue of normal medical considerations, right? As you move into an urban space, the population who lives there has all of the normal medical needs of a civilian population in homeostasis, in their regular state. So there are elderly and those with heart conditions who need nitro. There are diabetics who need insulin. There are those with bipolarity or mental health who need lithium or other kinds of pharmaceuticals. Obviously, there are civilian populations with babies or pregnant women who need babies delivered. All of this goes into the sustainment planning because you need to, when you move into an urban operation and especially in large-scale combat operations, you're going to disrupt the normal supply of these, and the civilian casualties that can result in can be significant. So thinking about and planning for how are you going to supply this. Additionally, public order becomes a really key consideration. There is a common myth, a common idea that public order will wait for this completion of your maneuver, that you'll maneuver, you'll conquer a city, and then afterwards you'll put in public order. But that doesn't really work very well for the civilian population. A very smart British officer I once knew pointed out to me that 10 meters of urban terrain taken are 10 meters of governance that you need to apply and you need to be responsible for. So how are you going to do that public order? We can imagine what happens when you don't do this public order. We can think about it. Obviously, Baghdad in 2003 is a really good example of that, where public order breaks down. And the results of this really undermines the coalition and starts to create knock-on problems. Additionally, you have to think about food and water, right? In the same way, the disruption of medical supplies is going to result from your maneuver, so will disruption of normal food and water. So thinking about where does the city normally receive its daily supplies from, right? How long can a city last with what's inside it already? And it's not just food and water supplies, obviously it's other kinds of medical supplies, it's power. A hospital that has no supplies at all is essentially a morgue, and not a refrigerated one. So you have to think about how are you going to provide those needs as you go in. And one of the last really big considerations to think about is planning for epidemics. And I know we have come out of the COVID period. We think of pandemics as something that may happen again, but are not the same as planning for LSCO. I will tell you, they are absolutely planning for large-scale combat operations in the urban environment is necessarily planning for epidemics. In almost every case of major city destruction, disease began to run rampant, and that's because of a couple of factors. First of all, the destruction of sewer systems. I know, John, in a previous podcast, you talked about the case in Gaza where destroyed sewer systems leaked raw sewage into the soil, and Israel actually took casualties from novel funguses that came from that. But multiply that at scale in terms of what's affecting the city. Also, civilians in urban areas under bombardment or under combat tend to take shelter together. This creates ideal incubation for disease. But smart planning can counter this. So we can look at the historical case of Naples. Naples, the Second World War, saw rapid spread of typhus during the Battle of Naples. The caseload went exponentially in its growth. So in the first week, it went from 250 people per week being noticed to be dead from the typhus epidemic to 700 people per week dying, and that went to the space of 1 week. At the rate of escalation, Naples was projected to have about 2 weeks left before the epidemic would wipe out the city. Initially, it meant that the Allied forces had to make the entire city and port area off limits. However, planning to counter typhus began at the national level for planners over a year prior to the Battle of Naples. And so the U.S. was able to rapidly deploy capabilities to Naples to fight and end the epidemic, saving thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even millions of lives, as well as make the city a useful part then of the Italian campaign. So what does this all mean? It means a couple of things. One, no U.S. division has sufficient organic capabilities to provide for a major urban area and to retain sufficient combat power for follow-on operations, right? It doesn't organically have the sustainment capabilities. It doesn't organically have the medical capabilities to sustain the population of an urban environment and sustain itself to allow for follow-on operations. So this has to be something that's put into planning before the operation begins. There are some ideas that, well, NGOs will take care of it. Most NGOs will not go into the immediate combat zone, and even still, you're going to have to coordinate with them. If you want a good model, though not urban, for thinking about that coordination, you can look at Combined Support Force 536 that existed in the wake of the Boxing Day or the East Asian and Indian Ocean tsunami. And that really created a model for how to coordinate with NGOs. But as a planner, it is not a safe assumption to assume the NGOs will be there. So you're going to have to think about how you provide all that. And that's before you even begin selecting an operational approach. So on the operational art level, there are some considerations for choosing an operational approach, some key elements of operational art that will help guide you through thinking about what approach to take. And these are end state and conditions first and foremost, right? What are you trying to achieve here? What is the prior, what are you trying to achieve with the city? Based on the end states and conditions that you're trying to achieve, will cut off a lot of the options and will make certain options preferential. Another one is phasing and transitions. A lot of the operational approaches we're going to talk about require very, very deliberate phasing and very deliberate transitions. And you should ask, do you have the ability to do those kinds of transitions? Do you have that ability to create that phasing? Additionally, tempo is a key issue. One of the things that has been shown in the recent Gaza operations, but is axiomatic in urban operations, is speed is not the same as success. A lot of people there conflate tempo and speed. So maintaining a deliberate tempo that matches your capabilities is absolutely critical when it comes to the urban fight. And all of this will underscore keeping you from reaching culmination, because it is very, very, very easy to culminate in the urban fight. So those are some considerations that we get before we even get to selecting kind of your operational approach. These are things that should drive your planning and will help you decide an operational approach.
Jacob, the one I like the most is where you agreed with me and not our friends Stu and Jason about the terrain favors the defense. I really like that part.
I am waiting for the angry email I'll get for them. But there, I've said it. I'm on the record. What can I do now?
No, those are all amazing. Go ahead. Sorry.
All right. So the first really option that a force has, and I'm going to say as a caveat, it's not an option the U.S. most likely has, other than perhaps in some very specific situations. It's not an option most moral armies have at this point, is to destroy the city, right? Anytime I talk about urban operations and different operational approaches, someone raises their hand and says, well, can't we just destroy the city? And then lists a whole bunch of examples of where forces have destroyed cities in the past. It does exist as an option. It exists as an option that perhaps our adversaries might use to bring down the entirety of the city. And there have been times where in the past the U.S. and its allies have used it. So in Le Havre in France, for example, the U.S. principally and our allies principally destroyed the city as a way to access the port. The advantages of this are, of course, it achieves decisive effects. If there is an adversary force in the city and you destroy it, then the adversary will be destroyed. It will save time in a lot of instances. It's faster than fighting your way through the city. And it will probably protect you from taking a lot of casualties. There are some significant downsides. First of all, is the ethical and moral consideration. In order to do this in an ethical and moral way, you have to be reasonably certain, to possibly entirely certain, that you are not systematically wiping out a civilian population. And because obviously not only is that a war crime, in most instances, it is also ethically and morally wrong. But it can also create, even with that aside, it can create a number of other problems. So you can't make use of the urban terrain afterwards because you've just destroyed it. In the case of Le Havre, for instance, the port was inoperable for a significant period of time because of the destruction our forces had caused. You also have the problem of moral injury on your own forces who may not be okay with destroying a city. And moral injury causes casualties just as surely as if they had been shot. You also have the long-term effect of any civilian casualties you cause on stability, and it will create other problems such as disease that we've already covered. So beyond the moral considerations, which makes this often, if not always, not the right choice, there and the legal considerations that have a similar effect, there are also some very practical reasons you may not want to choose this option beyond those. So if you're not going to destroy the city, and you're not going to bypass the city, because that's also an option, right? You could attempt to bypass it, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Another option is to assault the city. And there are a number of different ways to assault the city, and what we're going to do now is talk about a number of those different approaches. The most classic way of assaulting the city, or an urban area, and I should use urban or built-up area, so anytime I say city, read urban or built-up area because of the aforementioned issue of echelon. So it doesn't matter if it's a city or a town or a sprawling suburb or whatever. We're really talking about this built-up dense terrain. So the one that, John, you referred to that you see the most at NTC or elsewhere is that of a deliberate assault. And this is kind of the most famous in our heads. This is when you think Stalingrad, this is what we're talking about. When you think Berlin, this is what we're talking about, right? We can create a huge historical line of deliberate assault. And essentially what deliberate assault does is it breaks down into three phases: a breach, a maneuver in the urban terrain, and then exploit when you've partially cleared the terrain of your adversary and you now move into your objective and using that terrain. And it has some distinct advantages, right? It allows for consolidation of your force and consolidation of gains. You are setting the tempo. You are going to put your forces at the breach. You're going to break through at the breach, hopefully. And you're going to keep your force relatively intact. It can also be the fastest way to conquer urban terrain, right? If you successfully conduct a breach, are into the enemy's area, and are able to maneuver and outmaneuver them to the objective, to your critical objectives or your key objectives and key terrain, whichever doctrinal family you come from and doctrinal term you want to use, you're at a distinct advantage. It also allows for continuous and decisive operations. You can destroy the enemy in the urban terrain, and so it's decisive and it's continuous because once you breach, you're into maneuver and exploit. You don't have to stop at any given point. But there are some really significant downsides. The first is that it is force intensive, right? It takes a lot of forces to conduct a breach and then maneuver in and clear the urban terrain. Anyone who's done a Rajish rotation can surely sympathize with that at National Training Center, but we could see it historically as well in practice. It can also be very slow. So the process of the breach can take quite a while, and then the process of clearing the key terrain in the city and pacifying the city can also take an inordinate amount of time. It can also devolve into multiple unlinked fights because of the maneuver, right? After you've breached, your forces are starting to maneuver, and because of the nature of urban terrain, they get disaggregated. And all this risks, therefore, rapid culmination and a high potential for civilian casualties because you're fighting through the urban terrain. And all of this leads to another problem, which is it has this approach can develop a gravitational pull all of its own. As the urban fight, as was the case, for instance, in Stalingrad, absorbs more and more of the force available to clear the city, to move to the key terrain, to move to the objective after the breach, it starts to pull in from around it. And so an urban fight that was not meant to be the main fight can actually become the main effort using this approach. There are some variations to this approach, and the first one I'll bring up is one that I'm going to borrow a name for Field Marshal Montgomery's approach to defeating the enemy called Colossal Cracks. It's not originally from urban operation, but it has a significant amount of application here. And the idea is roughly that you build up combat power. You concentrate your forces at the point of the breach. You allow the enemy, by the way, to concentrate their forces at the point of the breach. And you hit them as hard as possible at the breach. You do as much damage as possible. And then you pause. And you pause before your force culminates in order to reconstitute, build up that amount of force again. let the enemy build up in front of you, and then repeat this kind of exercise. So this is an enemy-focused approach, and the goal is to repeatedly hit the enemy, to repeatedly attrit them into such a time as they can no longer hold a defense. So you're conducting this kind of repeated breach maneuver, this repeated decisive battle, as it were. Some of its key advantages are that it reduces the chance of a dissipation of effort by overextension. So in deliberate assault, as you hit that maneuver phase, you can overextend your forces and you can have dissipation of effort. In this, you're keeping extreme coherence of your force. You're not dissipating them. You're keeping them fairly concentrated. It allows for decisive victory because you can completely attrit and defeat the enemy. Or eventually they retreat because they can't take another deliberate assault in that way. They can't take another crack, as it were. And so they retreat and turn over terrain to you for free. And it sets the start and end points of each effort based on conditions or terrain to retain maximum efficacy. So you know exactly what the end point of your maneuver is. So you're going to hit the enemy, and you can either create conditions after we've been attrited this much, or after we've captured this terrain, we stop, we reconstitute, and we build up for it again. And of course, it does allow transition to exploitation and maneuver once the enemy is broken by these repeated assaults. You can then maneuver to your heart's content because you have sufficiently attrited the enemy to the point that they can no longer really function. Of course, there are some disadvantages of this. It results in repeated breaching of enemy prepared positions, even if they're hasty defenses. And so therefore it is very engineer and fires heavy. It can also be potentially very slow, right? Because you pause, you build up, you hit, attack them again, you pause, you build up and attack them again. And of course it gives the enemy the opportunity to prepare a deliberate defense in already favorable terrain. You're going to telegraph where you're coming because you really want the enemy to concentrate there. It's almost Clausewitzian in its sense. You want their main effort concentrated against their main effort. And so you're going to telegraph roughly where you're coming. And as a result of this, the enemy will have a chance to prepare. I mean, they may not know exactly where you're coming. Deception can be part of this. Some limited encirclements can be part of it. But the goal is really to destroy their main force. And because you're doing these repeated high fires, high engineer, high kinetics efforts, it does have the potential for high civilian casualties. There's another variation on deliberate assault, though, to talk about, which I'm going to credit John Spencer for the name, is called raising the flag. And in this case, what you're going to do is you're going to breach on a narrow front, and you're going to breach rapidly, and you're going to try to seize either key terrain or the city center or culturally significant or key terrain, things that matter to the enemy. And then you're going to switch to the defensive on that point and force the enemy, or invite them really, to attack you at that position. So you switch to the defense, get some of those defensive advantages of urban terrain, and invite the enemy to attack you. It maintains your force cohesion, at least during the initial phase, because you're keeping everyone together. You're not dispersing to clear the city. It allows for concentration at a decisive point. And it potentially alters the defender and offense equation. However, it does have some significant risks to it. It places your lines of communication at risk, right? What this ends up creating is something that looks a little bit like a bubble attached to a string, or a balloon attached to a string. And very naturally, your adversary may concentrate on the string rather than the balloon. And so protecting your line of communication is going to be really important in your ability to do this. It risks isolation. Should that line of communication be cut, you then have a force isolated in an urban environment. And it also complicates casualty evacuation as a result of that. Finally, it relies on forces outside the urban environment. When you've put your force into the urban environment, you have not brought everything with you, right? You've not brought all of your maintenance assets. You've not brought all of your sustainment assets, and you certainly haven't brought all of your fires assets. So it requires coordination between the force inside the city, whose done is raising the flag, and the force outside of the city. And that becomes key to its success. There's another variation, and this is really the kind of last variation on deliberate assault to talk about, that is based on a solution to the problems of the First World War. So I mentioned that one of the problems of urban terrain is that it is dense over an extended area and creates multiple lines of defense. And your enemy has lots of ability kind of to defend that terrain in depth. This is not significantly different in some respects from the problem that was faced by First World War planners on the Western Front, who were dealing with 3 and 5 mile complex defenses, or even 1 mile, 2 mile complex defenses, right, that were layered. And the British, particularly Rawlinson, had an idea that the problem came because they could almost always breach the first line of defense. They can conduct the breach, but they could not sustain their momentum, nor could they move to exploit the gains that they made, and that often led to defeat with the German counterattack that inevitably followed. And so what they came up with was this concept of bite and hold. And for those following along in doctrine, this has been incorporated into the new ATP for brigade attack for brigade operations in urban environments. So you can check it out there. It's now doctrinal. And the concept really is that you mass overwhelming force in a very limited area. You consciously limit your gains to easily digestible areas, and then you transition that to the defense to make use of the defensive advantages of the terrain. So essentially, you take a small chunk of an urban area, a manageable chunk that you know you can do, and to do that, you concentrate overwhelming resources to take that. You concentrate as much as you can to create an overwhelming situation against your enemy. And you take that, and then you switch on to the defense in that area. Then you rinse and repeat in a different area. So you've taken one area, you switch on to the defensive in that area, and that allows you to concentrate resources on another breach in a different area. And you keep taking these bites of the city until you have shaped your position, or more to the point, shaped the enemy's position to such a point as their defense is no longer practical, right? That you've partially encircled them, or that they can't actually hold a defense, or that they risk annihilation in some other form. And so it's a repeated, slow, and deliberate process. Eventually, the multiple breaches in multiple locations shape the enemy or force them to take very high casualties in counterattacking, where you have prepared for the defense, because your second part of this is after each bite, you hold, you switch to the defense. And so now they have to attack your prepared defenses. Your advantages with this one is it allows the attacking force to retain combat power and concentrate it. It allows massing of effects on decisive points, and it keeps the initiative with you as the attacker. It also allows for a change of the advantages of the terrain, since after you take an area, you immediately begin to dig in and prepare its defense. Its key disadvantages, though, is it sacrifices speed for initiative and tempo. So you, as the attacker in this scenario, control the tempo. You control the initiative as you decide where you're going to make your bites, but you sacrifice speed. It also limits gains, right? You are deliberately limiting your gains from each breach, and you do not plan that a given breach will transition into exploitation or rapid maneuver. Rather, you wait until the entire concept has done its job, until the enemy is in an unsustainable position, and then you transition. So, in essence, this is a non-decisive form of operation. In aggregate, it's decisive, but no one maneuver on it. So what are your planning considerations to know whether you want to do this? First of all, can you maintain the tempo, right? Can you make a bite and then rapidly transition to the defense and then make another bite in rapid enough time that the enemy cannot adjust? Can you manage the phasings and transitions, right? This requires repeated transition between breach and defense, breach and defense, breach and defense. And will you recognize the ability to transition to decisive operations when the time comes? This may be, end up being a quite attritional approach as a result. So another way to think about going after urban terrain is one that's somewhat theoretical, which is what's called nonlinear assault. And this is really kind of transitions us away from deliberate assault, but it is still a form of it. And this is often confused with the tactic of walking through walls. Some have called it fractal operations. And essentially what you have in this is you deliberately split up your force. So you do not maintain force concentration. You create task-organized mixed combat teams or combined arms teams that operate in bubbles with no fixed movement and phases lines towards the objective. So essentially what you do is you understand the objective in the urban terrain, the area to which they need to reach or the phase line to which they need to reach or even to get through the urban terrain. As a division, you would break your division up into brigades. You would give the brigades each, and this is an example, you could break them up other ways. You would give them each a percentage of all of the enablers that are available, including the fires. And you give them the final objective that they need to reach. And then you leave it to them to make their movement. What you do, though, is you have them coordinate cross with each other. So it's non-hierarchical coordination. And as they're moving, the main effort, which brigade is supporting and which brigade is the main effort, or which component is the main effort and which is supporting, will switch repeatedly. It will switch based on which one is actually moving at that time. So as one makes gains, the other two become supporting and throw their weight behind it. As that stalls in the dense urban terrain, the other ones that have more ability to move keeps the main effort. So it allows you to shift rapidly among axes of advance. It sacrifices coordination for the maintenance of initiative and movement. It sows historically confusion among the enemy, and it maximizes flexibility and allows you to retain momentum. It really reduces the risk of you getting bogged down. But it can result in multiple isolated battles as each one of your bubbles can stall out, and each one needs more support than is available. There are historical analogies to this, especially on the defense, and there are a couple of examples of it historically on the offense. But it is a quite rare approach to use. However, it does exist in the toolbook. The last variation of assault I want to talk about really starts transitioning us from assault, and that's raid to displace, disintegrate, or degrade. In this case, what you do is rather than try to take the city at once, rather than try to assault an urban area at once, you exercise repeated raiding against it. And this has the purpose of, in one sense, to make the enemy feel insecure in their positions. So if you can repeatedly and successfully raid their positions in the urban environment, they may withdraw. It may break the enemy's morale. It may make them decide to withdraw to a safer position. Additionally, you could use this to raid their capabilities. So if you can use intelligence to identify where some of their critical capabilities are, you can raid their critical capabilities, and in doing so, force them to withdraw, or alternatively, force them to shape them for a follow-on assault. Or you can disintegrate their C2 to make it easier for a follow-on assault. But in any case, the idea here is not to try to take the city at once, but try to repeatedly raid it to shape the enemy, and ideally to shape them to such a point that they withdraw. It minimizes the risk and reward from an individual operation. If you're conducting repeated raids and one doesn't work, this is not really a big deal. But also, if one does work, it's unlikely that a given raid will force the enemy to withdraw. It involves repeated breaches and retrogrades, two of the hardest operations in military planning. And it is heavily reliant on intelligence and tempo. In order to make this raiding strategy work, you have to keep up the tempo of raids, so at no point do they feel safe in their position. at best, it should be time to take advantage of windows of opportunity created by previous raids. So if in one raid, as a result of one raid, you clear observation posts in a sector, then another raid should follow up to do further damage in that sector. Or if a radar system is destroyed, then perhaps you should exploit that using more UAVs or air as part of your next raid in that. And you, if you're doing this to degrade, you have to prevent the enemy from fully reconstituting. So this has to be conducted at a high tempo to keep them from being able to reconstitute after your raids. Another way to get after the city that really isn't a deliberate assault, but results in one, is to infiltrate it. We have tons of examples of where this has been used, and there are different ways to infiltrate the city, and I'll talk about both of them. One of these examples include Shusha in the last Nagorno-Karabakh War, Hue, Paris in 1944, Marseille in 1944, and of course Arnhem in the Second World War during Market Garden as well. And what you'll notice from these is that they're a mixed bag of success and failure. The essential idea is that you put forces inside the urban environment, either soft or airborne or indigenous forces, so that you are fighting inside the city before or simultaneous to your assault from the outside of the city. In order for this to work, it's dependent on weaknesses of the internal security and the enemy's control of the city, right? Indigenous forces will not do very well if there are large amounts of capable security forces and intel watching them. It usually, especially if you want to use indigenous forces, requires you to establish networks in the city prior to the campaign. So if you're a commander and you wake up one morning and say, I want to do this operational approach, let's make it happen, I can almost guarantee your SF or intel or whoever it is who in your force structure who's working with indigenous forces will say, well, sir or ma'am, that's a great idea, but we needed to put those networks in place a year or 2 years beforehand in order to do that. And because of that difficulty, another approach is to use airborne or air assault to put forces into the city itself. Obviously, this has all of the risks that airborne and air assaults have, where you can risk defeat in detail. And this is the case in Market Garden, where the airborne is defeated inside an urban area before the relief force assaulting from outside can get to them. And that becomes a really big problem. I think an ideal sense is the Battle of Marseille, where the uprising in the city was timed with the beginning of the assault from outside the city, so they knew time was on their side. So we've established there are a number of different ways to deliberately assault a city. All of them are difficult. All of them have their problems, so you may not want to do them. So if that's difficult, what else do you have? Well, another approach is to isolate or besiege a city and shake a stick at any historical war that involves urban areas, and you're going to find this having been done or at least attempted. The advantage of besieging or isolating a city is it avoids the problems of fighting in the city, right? If you are on the outside, if you're cutting it off, you don't really need to go inside. And it allows for decisive victory. Eventually, without resources, without water, without ammunition, without food, enemy force will be forced to surrender, or the lack of water and food will do the job for you. It has a predictable time and resource requirement. If you have a good intelligence picture of what resources were in the city at the beginning of the siege, then you can predict roughly how long it will take for the enemy to surrender or otherwise be defeated. In fact, historically, in the late early modern period, the French commander Vauban was famous for being able to not only predict that, but predict how long a city wall would work, almost to, in some stories, the hour or the minute, but certainly to the day. There are disadvantages to this, though. It has a huge force requirement because you have to not only protect your force from the forces inside the city, you have to protect it from the possibility of relief forces coming outside. It significantly slows your tempo because you have to stop where you are and hold the city. It can also create a siege mentality within the city, where a fighting force that might not have had popular support develops popular support because they're all in it together. And your biggest disadvantage and your biggest challenge with this is ultimately it relies on the denial of food and water to succeed, which generally also means denial of food and water to the civilian population. You can allow humanitarian aid in, of course, but it is likely that humanitarian aid will get co-opted by the defending force. And so this becomes ethically and legally a very, very tricky scenario to play out in a way where you are denying food and resources to the defenders, but not to the civilians. So what should you ask yourself if you're going to engage in this? Well, first of all, do you have the force and time? Can you really cut off all the resources? Will there be resources flowing through in that will keep your enemy supported and sustained? What is the likelihood that the enemy morale will collapse before they have to die of starvation or lack of resources? Do you have the intelligence to understand the subterranean infrastructure that can support the city and the areas you need to control to cut it off? And can you provide your own security? And I want to really pick up on that subterranean theme. When you think of modern cities, especially larger ones, your London, New York, etc., tunnels from those cities, both currently used and disused, extend miles and miles from the city center and well into, in some cases, rural areas or other urban centers. And so where you need to cut off the city, if you don't understand the subterranean terrain, may not be particularly obvious. So there are variations of this that go more into isolation rather than siege. And one variation is to control but do not enter. In this case, what you're looking to do is allow for other friendly forces to continue their maneuver and bypass the city, while at the same time preventing the forces in the city from causing a problem. So you're avoiding a certain aspect of the urban fight. You're staying outside the city. You're isolating it. You are letting supplies, especially humanitarian supplies or dual use supplies, go into it. And you're basically keeping a masking force who's going to try to control by fire the enemy in the city, make sure they can't come out of it, make sure they can't threaten your other maneuvers. It does lead to a whack-a-mole approach of the threat emanating from the urban environment, where they really set the initiative and tempo. They attack when they want to try to break out, and you have to keep driving them back. This means the objective for your forces controlling the urban environment but not entering it is a little bit unclear. They're there to stop the enemy but not necessarily destroy them. They're going to be there for an indefinite time. There's no sense of how long this will last. And it's really best employed when you have no objective in the urban environment, when that particular urban area is not important to you and there's nothing you're trying to achieve there. Another variation of isolation is to isolate in support of local forces. This would be a case where you have local forces who are capable in the city but could use enabling support and are only capable should no relief come to your enemy from outside the city. So in these cases, you don't enter the city. You stay outside, but you coordinate support with them. And so what you're going to try to do is especially fires, reconnaissance, sustainment, these kinds of things, you may provide them, but you're not really going to go in yourself. And this has a lot of advantages. It negates a lot of the problems of assault. It negates some of the problems of siege because you're working with a local force, but you have to predetermine what kinds of support you will and will not provide. It can lead you sucked into the fight very, very quickly. You have to plan in advance how much support do you need to provide. And of course, how long as well? How long will it take your local forces, your local partners to take the city? But the problem with all of this is, of course, it only works if you're willing to accept their failure, right? If the city is a must-take for you, then you probably need to have a firmer grip on your ability to take it because there is a possibility the local forces will fail. And in that case, then you're left half back at the drawing board. You also have to think about how do you minimize support for possible war crimes? If you're supporting the local force kind of unquestioningly, and it is a critical mission for you to take the city, what do you do if the local force starts behaving badly, starts committing war crimes? At what point do you cut off support for them, from them? And what are the second and third order implications of doing that? There are then the idea beyond these of kind of mixed methods of besieging a city or to infiltrate it later, right? Establishing a cordon and then trying to infiltrate and start a local uprising, or besieging or isolating a city in order to set conditions for an assault, or besieging it and then repeatedly raiding it. So just because you take one of these operational approaches, one of the isolation-based operational approaches initially, does not mean that's where you have to stay. It can enable your other approaches, but of course it still has the issue of time and force. The last thing I really want to talk about here, which comes up repeatedly, is that of bypassing the city, right? All of these approaches have downsides and positives, and none of them are 100% great, right? Not a single one you're looking at is, I think, as from a, if I were a planner, is something that I'd absolutely really want to do. They all have significant challenges and significant downsides. And so it seems then that the easy answer is just don't. Just bypass the city, ignore it, don't make it your problem. Let supplying the city and taking care of the civilian population be an adversary's headache. This would avoid all of the problems that come up and essentially relies on the fact that the adversary in the bypass city will eventually either withdraw or surrender, or you can win the war before they become a significant problem. But there are significant disadvantages, things that draw you into cities. First of all, cities often have the critical supplies, key terrain, critical resources that you actually need. The second problem is, what happens if your enemy does not withdraw? Is you've bypassed the city, you've partially encircled it, but you have not left a lot of forces to guard it, and the enemy stays where they are. Well, now you have an enemy in a fortified area, potentially astride your line of communication or very near to it. And this can result in, as a secondary task, now bringing forces back from the maneuver to besiege. So it can result in unintended sieges or leave an open sore behind you. But there's something else to think about, is can you really bypass the city? The Allied plan in 1944 was to bypass Paris on the way to Germany, to leave it as the Germans' problem and continue on to Germany. But for our French allies, that was not an acceptable solution. The French begin an uprising in Paris. The French military departs from our operational plan and starts turning towards Paris. And suddenly we find ourselves in the battle for Paris. So Paris ended up having a gravity all of its own. And that required forces to go in, whether or not we intended them to. There are other approaches to cities, such as re-engineering it, where if the enemy is defending a part, and this is where I will, by the way, agree with Stuart Lyle and Jason Giroux, that the city doesn't necessarily favor the defender, because you can open new avenues. The urban terrain, the dense built-up terrain that the enemy is using on their defense can be bypassed with enough engineering assets and enough time, opening new lines and roads that isolate the enemy's defense or bypass it. The problem with this, of course, is it is very, very engineering heavy. It is very time intensive, and it requires specialist equipment, such as the D9 bulldozer, which is not available to every force, and it requires security for that equipment. But in any of these operational approaches, is something to keep in mind. So that covers most of the kind of general approaches that you can take. There are variations in different ways to approach them. The Soviets, late in the Second World War, had a very interesting way to divide up their divisions of light, rapidly moving forces that identified and bypassed strongholds with light engineering assets, which were then followed by assault forces who made initial breaches and found strong points and strongholds and assaulted them, and were then followed by a clearing force who slowly and methodically cleared the city, allowing the other forces to continue on. And once accesses of advance were opened up for follow-on forces to leapfrog. And they divided up their different enablers, like military police, intelligence, and their equivalent of civil affairs, which wasn't terribly civil, among those forces. So the light forces didn't have all of those assets. The assault forces had the majority of armor and engineering assets. And the clearing forces had the majority of military police and kind of second line assets and rear area assets. So they divided them up. And there are lots of different ways to divide up your force. That's a particularly good one when you encounter urban terrain. But to wrap up, I really can't say which operational approach you're going to end up using as you encounter urban terrain. But I will say historically, these broad categories represent the menu of options. And as a planner or as a commander, what it will come to you to do is to look at this menu, look at the advantages and disadvantages, look at the specific conditions, especially the issue of end state for the urban terrain you're encountering, look at your force structure, and then weigh up which approach is best for you.
Jacob, thank you so much. And that was a lot. We didn't talk about this, but I was wondering if you mind if I go through a rapid listing of the operational approaches you gave with the historical example in them.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So number one, destroy, while very unpractical within the accordance of the law of war, as I'm not a historian, you are, something important to study as one of the approaches. And the example you gave was the 1944 destruction of the port city of Le Havre.
Yep. Le Havre in France. Exactly.
Yeah. Number two, of course, is just a classic assault with many variables. Number one, the deliberate attack. Example was 1942-43 Stalingrad. Would you put the 2016-17 Battle of Mosul in that just attack category?
So my understanding of the Battle of Mosul, and you know it better than I do, John, is that it had an element of isolate before the assault, but then ultimately was a deliberate assault.
Yeah. I didn't want to mention it because I know we're talking about operational approaches, but in a deliberate attack, the isolate is usually the first step. And some people get that confused with besieging when isolation is pretty much a very big part of the attack. There's some nuances there. Okay. Number two within attack is Colossal Crack, which has an awesome name. And you gave the 1942 El Alamein in Egypt and Normandy, right?
Right. So El Alamein in Egypt isn't an urban battle, but it is one where you can see kind of the idea of colossal cracks played out. There, the crack is very quick. There's only one or two, and then it begins the maneuver phase. And if you look at Montgomery's operations, including in some of the urban areas of Normandy, he does theoretically conduct colossal cracks. He at least claims he does. So it's not the entirety of the Normandy battle, but it is Montgomery's follow-on operations in his sector of Normandy.
All right, we'll leave it in there just for Stuart. The next one, raised a flag. I appreciate that naming credit. Punched in the middle of the city, turn around, make them fight you. The example, the 2004 Second Battle of Fallujah, 2002 Jenin, right?
So 2002 Jenin has elements of that in it. I'm not 100% convinced it's a pure version of it, but it definitely has attempted elements of it, and I'm not saying it's a successful attempt, by the way.
Okay.
There's also possibly the Battle of Ennahda in the 2006 Lebanon War.
Great. The next one, which I know made it into doctrine, and congratulations, the course, the influence on doctrine has been a very big byproduct of the 4 years of running the course, bite and hold. So you gave the examples of some World War I battles like the Menin Road Ridge. But would you also put the 2006 Battle of Ramadi, the cop in a box, bite it off, 3 or 4 days later, do it again? Would you put Ramadi in that bite and hold category?
to my knowledge, Ramadi does have some similarities with it, as does the 2023 Israeli offensive into northern Gaza. Again, because all of these are generalized concepts, each of these has variations to it, right? Different ways it's done and different approaches that reflect it. So I think Ramadi has some characteristics of it. I wouldn't say that the planners of Ramadi were sitting down and going, oh yeah, bite and hold, this is what we're going to do. But it does reflect it to an extent, as does the deliberately slow tempo and repeated entries into Gaza across multiple directions that the Israelis did in 2023.
Okay. So then we have the non-linear assault. You call them brigade boxes or bubbles. I like bubbles. I call this like the bubble non-linear assault, but with some examples in Korea and not in North Africa, right?
Right. And those are examples, not necessarily, again, in urban environments, but where you can really see this being carried out. The Battle of Bir Hakeim in North Africa and the brigade boxes that were used in Korea by the U.S. as well. And the classic example of this is the Battle of the Kasba in Nablus in 2002, which is kind of where the concept was named from.
Okay. Raid to displace, which absolutely see it in the summer of 2024 with IDF operations in Gaza, but you also referenced some operations during 1948 War of Independence, right?
Yeah. This is one that Israel has historically done really quite a lot. And so looking at Israeli 1948 operations and even some later operations by them, you can see this as a repeated pattern in how they tend to like to operate historically.
Great. So out of assaults, we get to infiltrate, which has a lot of risk in all the considerations you talked about, but we gave the 2020 Battle of Susha that I had the honor of walking the ground, 68 Battle of Wei, if you're on North Vietnamese VC side, and the 1944 Arnhem, right?
Yep, Arnhem, and then Marseille and Paris as well have elements of this.
Great. Next, isolate and besiege, starting off with like classic siege. So you had like 1941 Siege of Leningrad, 1941 Battle of Kyiv, the largest encirclement in military history, as examples of the siege, like classical besiege, right?
Right.
And then the isolate control without entering, you gave 2006 and Bet Jemel.
Binjbel, yeah.
Yeah, with the Battle of Sadr City that I happened to be a part of in 2008 also, since we didn't enter the city.
Yeah, I think the Battle of Sadr City has a lot of similarities to this, with the idea that you're really cutting it off from where you're interested in operating. You're not trying to go in, but you're trying to keep the bad that was happening in Sadr City from spreading to other areas. So yeah, that would definitely look like this.
Right. Which is a selfless plug that the case study that me, Jason, and Liam Collins wrote is about complete and ready for the next version of the Urban Warfare Project case studies, if you haven't read those. Next in the line of the isolate and besiege is isolate in support of local forces, and you gave 1982 Beirut as an example.
Yep, and that's an example that's really useful because it shows both the good and the bad of that approach, right? It was ultimately operationally successful, but there were massacres that were carried out during that. There were lots of bad. And the Battle of Deber Marcos in Ethiopia during the Second World War is another case where you could see this with a few less of the downsides.
Got it. And then, of course, the one that most of us urbanistas reject, but you can't in history or the operational approach, is the idea of bypassing. Would you include the drive to Baghdad? And what was, I think, what they thought they were going to do, if I'm not wrong, in like the Battle of Najaf, they planned to bypass it, but the 101st ended up having to fight for the city just to control those logistical lines.
Yeah, and this is something I'll go back to on bypass. It's really hard to actually bypass the city. They have a gravity all their own. They'll pull you in. So Paris in 1944 and Najaf, where they're going to try to bypass it and end up having to go back and fight in it. Right. These are really constant problems that come up every time you try to bypass a city.
Right. And I agree with you that, and this is what I got to observe in you teaching, and we do the war game in the urban operations planner course, is that these are many methods. And usually sometimes you see a mixed method, whether it's brigade and divisions, even in the same fight.
Yeah, absolutely. These are approaches. And what you might is have them at different approaches operating at different echelons. So if a division is taking an approach of, say, raid to this place, their brigades may still be doing deliberate assault, right? So at different echelons, you're going to see different approaches employed. Or in 2023 in North Gaza, if the core level is doing this kind of bite and hold, the divisions are still very much into deliberate assault, and the brigades even more so. So actually, in that case, the brigades are doing a lot more raiding even. And so you can see at different echelons, different approaches coming through.
Great. Well, Jacob, I know you've given me a lot to think about, and you always do. And this is why I wanted to bring you on the course. When we start this in our course, it gives everybody, all the planners and commanders, something to think about, is that there's more than one way. History provides many examples. There are all these considerations to include elements of operational art. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me, John.
Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out NWI's other podcasts, as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.